Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our distinguished guest today is Pakistani journalist and author Ahmed Rashid. He's the author of Taliban, Jihad, Descent into Chaos, and his new book is Pakistan on the Brink. Ahmed, welcome back to Berkeley.
Thank you.
Let's talk about Pakistan first. And is Pakistan as a state frozen in time?
I think in many aspects it is. I think we were a leading ally of the U.S. in the Cold War, and we've never really got out of that syndrome. Everything changed in the region, in the world community after the end of the Cold War. Countries had to get on without their sponsor, whether it was the Soviet Union or the United States. And we kept looking, if you like, to the United States to bail us out of economic problems, to bail us out with India, to bail us out even, in Afghanistan. And it was a totally false relationship, but somehow the U.S. military in particular and successful U.S. government sustained, very wrongly, I think, given the fact that, the whole area changed. The U.S. was shifting its friendship now to India, which had been in the Soviet camp before. Pakistan did not wake up to that reality. And domestically, the same thing happened. There was a continuation of quasi-military rule or direct military rule. Democracy was not allowed to flourish, and the military retained control of foreign policy, which was the main string for the government's survival. And really, this old narrative has continued ever since. Sometimes I think we're almost on par with North Korea and Iran for having maintaining a foreign policy that is completely antiquated and has nothing to do with what the real task of government should be, that is making people's lives better and improving people's lives. But you don't do that by maintaining a huge nuclear arsenal, a huge military. You do that by spending more money on education and health and job creation.
So in a way, the Pakistani elite has failed both at home and abroad. Talk a little more about how it has failed at home, because it really never established a national identity.
Well, that's very true. I mean, we've had this, we've had four military, spates of military rule. More than half of Pakistan's history has been under the military. And of course, when the military comes in, it stymies any democratic growth, not just for that period, but for the decade afterwards also. Because young people don't go into politics, they don't believe in parliamentary politics, or they don't believe that parliamentary politics will survive. So we've had these periods of military rule followed by elections, followed by democratic rule, which eventually fails, and then more military rule follows. And it's a vicious circle that we are wrapped in.
And it's neither the civilian or the military rulers address the problems of the people, from what you're saying.
Exactly. I mean, if you look at the situation today, we have a literacy rate of around 55%. Which is almost the same as it was 30 years ago. It's just kept up with population growth. Healthcare is abysmal. We haven't, in the last 20 years of globalization, we haven't created any new industry. We're still dealing with things like textiles and industries that go back to the 50s, rather than set up new high-tech kind of industries like India has done. We have insurgencies in two of the country's four provinces, one a separatist insurgency in Baluchistan, and then, of course, the Taliban insurgency in the northwest corner of the country. And that is spreading. I mean, more and more suicide bombings. You've got major ethnic upheaval in Karachi. Hundreds of people are killed every month in Karachi because of ethnic and sectarian violence. So you've got an unimaginable raft of problems, none of which are being particularly well addressed. And most of them are related to the lack of economic growth. If you could provide jobs and education, I think a lot of this violence would get off the streets, and people would think more about, you know, making good for themselves.
We should remind our audience that Pakistan's geopolitical strategic position in the world should make it a hub to benefit from globalization, and in fact, it's become a hub for terrorism.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, if you look at Pakistan is the land bridge between Central Asia to the north and the Gulf states in the Arabian Gulf. It's a land bridge between Iran and India. It's a land bridge in many different directions. And just if you were to build up the communications and the infrastructure and make peace with your neighbors, we have a running battle with India. We have a running battle with Afghanistan. Make peace with your neighbors. Allow the neighbors to trade across your country. Oil and gas pipelines from Central Asia could come in and feed India and Pakistan, which are both countries which are hugely deficient in energy. Electricity could come in. All this was the hope. People like myself were hoping that after the Cold War, this is what, you know, the new era would bring. Instead, after the end of the Cold War, we continued backing the Taliban in Afghanistan, which led, of course, to the civil war, the continuation of the civil war, and eventually 9/11. Also, we continued backing the Pakistani militants who were fighting in Indian Kashmir. So we had two wars going on both our borders, on the east and the west, rather than, you know, ending these wars, making peace with the neighbors, and trying to take advantage of our geopolitical situation.
So this is a real failure of leadership. How do you explain that? Why has both the civilian and the military leadership done such a poor job of addressing these really important problems?
I think the bottom line is that the military, which has basically controlled foreign policy for the last 30, 40 years, sees Pakistan as a national security state. It sees Pakistan constantly under threat, either from India or from Afghanistan. It doesn't want to turn these threats into plowshares, if you like, or, you know, peaceful assets, which would promote trade and other things. As long as we view ourselves as a national security state, it means you have to have an army of 700,000 men, you've got to have nuclear weapons, you've got to have 30% of the budget going to the military. Now, I think finally, I mean, people have woken up to this. I mean, I think the very the very serious problems the military has faced in the last year or so is a reflection of the fact that the media, the public, civil society, people in education, in the health sector, are really fed up with the fact that there's no money for anything except the military. And our development has collapsed. Our economy is virtually collapsed. We have no energy. We have I've had no gas for 6 months in my house in Lahore. We have 12 hours a day no electricity. You know, there's just been no investment in these kinds of things which keep countries running. You know, and instead we are making nuclear bombs faster than any other country in the world, including India and the United States or Russia. So I think, you know, the whole development and the way we view ourselves, the way the military and the civilians view themselves, is totally lopsided.
Mm-hmm. And is there a new narrative emerging? And then what is the basis for it within the leadership circle and in the population? In other words, is it that people generally and the leadership is seeing all the array of problems that you've just discussed?
Well, I think, you know, in the last few years, people, especially younger people, are sick and tired of this old narrative of being a national security state, of failure to do reform, etc. And they're prepared to listen to, I mean, people like myself, for example. I mean, I wouldn't get a hearing anywhere 10 years ago, or, you know. Right now, young people at universities and around the country want to read my books. They want to hear what I have to say, because it's at odds with the accepted status quo of what they read every day, you know, in the newspapers. And more, if you look at the social media, blogging, the newspapers, more and more young people are really looking for some kind of change. And, for example, there's a new political phenomenon in Pakistan where you have the former cricketer, Imran Khan, who's attracted enormous numbers of people to his political party. He'll be fighting the elections because young people are fed up with the older politicians. They're fed up with the military. They want to try something new. So I think, you know, this new narrative, which is really we should talk back to power. We should be honest with ourselves. We should stop blaming the Americans and the Indians and the Israelis for every ill event that happens in Pakistan. But we should look inward into ourselves first. We should stop spending money on the military and becoming this kind of frontline state for whose benefit. We should spend more money on, you know, development and other things. So I think this kind of narrative is certainly, and of course it's a sea change because, you know, we spent more than 60 years ensconced in this narrative of that India is the enemy. You have to support the army because we have to stand up to India. Well, India has now got a 7-8% growth rate. And I always tell my audiences in Pakistan, no country with an 8% growth rate can afford to go to war. Can never go to war. They've got far too much to lose. But a country with a 2% growth rate, which is what Pakistan has, can always afford to go to war because we've got nothing to lose economically. But if you have got a growth rate like 8% and you're a global capitalist power, you've made investments all over the world, the whole world is rushing to you to make investments in your country, you're not going to go to war. So we should wake up to this new reality. You know, Indians want to trade with us. They want to use the land bridge that Pakistan offers to trade with Central Asia, to trade with the Gulf.
So what will lead to the breakout to this new narrative and its implementation? Will it be some event? Will it be the emergence of a new leader? You know what? Because you have, under the old narrative, entrenched interests, which we will talk about in a second.
Well, I think, unfortunately, those entrenched interests are fighting very fiercely to prevent any emergence of a new narrative. You know, especially the military and a lot of the right-wing politicians, the fundamentalist Islamic parties, they're all fighting. They want to maintain the status quo. And certainly among those advocating a new narrative, people like myself or the younger generation, I would say right now there's no particular leadership which is strong enough or genuine enough that they can follow. And so what we are going to see is basically change is going to come about through a process. And I think what has to happen is we have to have hopefully a continuation of democratic rule. Even if that democracy is going to be corrupt and incompetent, it's still going to be better than military rule, which military rule ends in a cul-de-sac. Military rule eventually ends with no answers, no political answers. It can't give the people anything. Now, the advantage of having a democracy, obviously, is that, you know, like this government today, presently, the People's Party, led by President Asif Ali Zardari, is generally deemed as incompetent and corrupt. We hope that there'll be elections in 2013, even earlier, perhaps, and many people hope that this government will be driven out of power through the ballot box, not through a military coup. So I think, you know, this process, the next government hopefully may be equally bad, but presumably once you instill this process, you know, I think we can make progress and a new narrative can emerge.
Let's talk a little about what the implications of the old narrative are with regard to Pakistan's foreign policy, its dealings with Afghanistan and so on. So the a key element has been the use of terrorists, really, to achieve strategic goals. What were those strategic goals for the Pakistani military? And then how has that kind of led to an unraveling by the logic of what they're doing?
Well, I mean, this goes back to the 1950s, even earlier, 1949. The first war we fought with India was fought with proxy tribesmen who were recruited to go into Indian Kashmir and try and capture it from the Indians. And since then, every war that that we have fought with India has, at some level or the other, involved Islamic fundamentalist militants who have been fighting on the side of the army, on the side of the country. Now, what has happened, of course, is that these militants really came to the fore against India in the 1990s when they were mobilized to fight in Kashmir. And they bogged down something like 600,000 troops of the Indian military in Kashmir. Now, that was seen by the Pakistan Army as a great strategic success, that here you have perhaps a few thousand militants from Pakistan, some from Kashmir, bogging down literally half the Indian army and making it impossible for the Indian army to attack Pakistan. But unfortunately, you know, this was then translated, rather than being a successful tactic, it was translated by the army into being a kind of strategy. And so we had extremely bad relations with India. We went to war with India in 1999 using the cover of the newly unveiled nuclear weapons as a cover to launch a military incursion into Kashmir, which ended in a disaster. And then after 9/11, even though we helped the Americans uncover, defeat the Taliban, provided bases for the Americans, what happens after the war ends is that all the Taliban and Al-Qaeda who've escaped come into Pakistan, and basically we give sanctuary to the Taliban. And we, the military and the intelligence services, relaunched the Taliban in 2003, to fight the Americans. Now, at the same time, the military goes after Al-Qaeda. And because President Bush at that time is saying to Pakistan, I'm not interested in the Taliban. You can do what you like with them. Just catch me, Al-Qaeda. And we do catch. Pakistan catches something like 500 members of Al-Qaeda. They're all shipped off to Guantanamo by the Americans. And Pakistan remains in Bush's good books, even though President Karzai and American commanders on the ground are complaining to Donald Rumsfeld and to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice that, look, the real problem here is that the Taliban, and the Taliban have got these sanctuaries in Pakistan. Do something about it. And Bush doesn't do anything about it. And so the situation gets worse. By the time President Obama takes over, you have a full-scale civil war. The Taliban has spread their influence across the country, and they're able to come back into Pakistan and regroup and rearm themselves and all the rest of it.
And what's important here is that there is a – what emerges is a Afghan Taliban – which is fighting us in Afghanistan. But then this whole process spawns what has now become a Pakistan Taliban. So in Shakespearean terms, the military is foisted by its own petard.
Exactly. And this is what, you know, has become so very dangerous, because the influence of Al-Qaeda and the Afghan Taliban living on Pakistani soil in proximity with, you know, Pakistan's Pashtun tribesmen who had already spent the last decade helping their Afghan brothers fight the Soviets, now help their Afghan brothers fight the Americans in Afghanistan, but then also decide, well, why should this, you know, why should a corrupt government be ruling us? We should have an Islamic State, just like the Taliban want an Islamic State in Afghanistan. And they launch their own Taliban movement against the military. And this takes off in a vicious way, suicide attacks, the murder of Benazir Bhutto and top politicians and army officers. And then they're joined by the very militants from Punjab, the largest province, who had been fighting the Indians in Kashmir. So you have a very broad-based militant movement, militants who'd fought in Afghanistan, militants who'd fought in Punjab, militants who'd fought in Kashmir, and militants who'd fought in Central Asia. And this new crop of militants are educated, urbanized, very sophisticated. They can launch attacks in Karachi or Lahore. You know, they're not swathi tribesmen who can't go into a major city. And so the threat increases. So Pakistan is caught in this double whammy. Even as it allows the Afghan Taliban to fight inside Afghanistan and gives them sanctuary, it goes up against the Pakistani Taliban. But this double strategy really doesn't work because both Afghan Taliban and Pakistani Taliban are enmeshed. And if you go up into the mountainside and you tell your troops, well, go kill that guy, but don't go kill that guy because he's our guy, you know, you are confused. You know, you have no strategy, basically, because naturally the two will protect each other.
And it becomes impossible to distinguish the provincial Taliban, the ones, for example, in Afghanistan, who use Pakistan as a base but who are focused on what happens in Pakistan, versus the international terrorists who are the original threat that brought us there in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, that's very true. I mean, I think the Al-Qaeda sort of central command under Osama bin Laden, as it existed for many years, is more or less depleted. Obviously, bin Laden has been killed. You still have his number two, Ayman al-Zawahiri. But I still maintain that Al-Qaeda has blossomed around the world since 9/11. Somalia, Yemen, Europe, they've got potential bases in almost every European country now, which they never had before 9/11. And you've had Al-Qaeda threats on the mainland in the U.S. Not necessarily people linked to some Osama bin Laden, but copycats, if you like, who want to emulate Al-Qaeda or believe in its philosophy. So what we've seen happening is that, you know, even though the Al-Qaeda threat has been, I think, marginalized in Pakistan to some extent, you had the whole growth of these other movements, Pakistani Taliban, Afghan Taliban, Central Asian groups, Chechens, all sorts of odd bods, you know, living there, training, etc. But you have seen also the growth of the Al-Qaeda around the world. And much of it gets linked to Pakistan, because what happens is that, whereas in the old days, you were militant in New York or London, you would travel to Pakistan to get training from Al-Qaeda in the border areas between Pakistan and Afghanistan. Now you travel to Pakistan to get training from these Taliban militants, the Pakistani Taliban. So Al-Qaeda, if you like, has kind of given off a lot of its responsibilities to the Pakistani Taliban. And so, for example, the Times Square bomber a year or so ago, who was a Pakistani, was trained by the Pakistani Taliban to carry out a bombing in New York. Now, so that means that the Pakistani Taliban have, or some of the Pakistani Taliban have developed a global agenda. They're not just satisfied in overthrowing the Pakistan government. They're actually supporting global terrorism. Mm-hmm. And that makes the Pakistani Taliban much more dangerous.
Now, another element here that we should point out to our audience is that Pakistan really never took control of the federal territories, these border areas, which are now the base for both the Afghan Taliban and the Pakistan. Talk a little about that, because these are even more impoverished areas, not under the government's control, unless it moves in with military forces.
Well, what used to be called the Northwest Frontier Provinces, which is now called the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa Province, KP, is really the border with Afghanistan. But there's a little sort of piece of land that juts into Afghanistan, which are called seven tribal agencies. Now, these were areas that were never conquered or occupied by the British. And they gave these areas a kind of autonomy. First they were scared of them because these tribes were very anti-British and, you know, they constantly raided British territories. But also these areas formed a buffer between British India and what was then Afghanistan. And we inherited this buffer, and this buffer remained. And this area was never integrated into the main major part of Pakistan. So, for example, the constitution doesn't apply there. The legal system in Pakistan doesn't apply there. The development of health, education, schools, everything else that, you know, the rest of the country has doesn't apply there. So it has become a very backward area, terrible growth rates. It's a small area. It has a population of no more than 3 to 4 million. Many of them have had to, the manpower have had to go to other parts of Pakistan to find jobs and work. And it is here that the Taliban and Al-Qaeda settled. And you can imagine Al-Qaeda bought all their millions of dollars into this highly impoverished area and literally bought their way into these tribal areas. They paid the locals for houses, for rents, for food. You know, they bought their women. I mean, there's a lot of buying and selling of women there. They bought their women and married them. They integrated into this tribal area through money, basically, buying their way in. And now, of course, they have very serious, they have very strong bases there. And that's where, and as a result of this, of course, the local tribesmen became indoctrinated and become part of this whole Taliban Al-Qaeda movement and become what we now call the Pakistani Taliban. So the crying aim is you've got to bring, it's not good enough now saying we'll spend, as the Americans have done, the Americans had a plan to spend, you know, $200 million in the tribal areas. First, you have to sort out its constitutional status. You've got to give them the same rights as other Pakistanis. You've got to end this autonomy. You've got to make them part of the Pakistan political system and bring this area into Pakistan. And that is something that, you know, the government, the army, etc., have so far failed to do.
Is the you've talked about the new narrative. You talked about how there's an emerging consciousness among the young and the broader populace that may take off. It would seem that at a certain point, this Frankenstein that the military has created using terrorists and not controlling these federal areas would lead it to change its focus on India as a threat. Will we ever see these forces and the instability that derives from them leading to a change in consciousness in the military about just making India the central focus of its strategy?
Well, I think it is leading to a big change. First of all, it has already led to a big change in civil society. You know, businessmen want to do business with India. Traders want to trade with India. Students want to go and study in India. You know, they've had enough of these restrictions, which are so ridiculous. I mean, this is the only two capitals in the world where there are no direct flights between the two capitals. I mean, there's no flight between Islamabad and Delhi. It's getting now, you know, getting a visa, going there is a major problem, a major headache. And people want this to end. There has been, I think, in the last few months, some improvement with India. I hope it is a strategic improvement rather than, you know, blowing hot and cold as these things. But India also has to, you know, help the process. India, there's still quite a strong movement in Kashmir, now increasingly for independence. India has to deal with this problem. And then it has to help resolve and end this territorial dispute with Pakistan. But at the moment, I would say the main area of focus is Afghanistan. India and Pakistan are fighting this war of rivalry and influence in Afghanistan. India has accused the Pakistani intelligence of using Afghan Taliban to attack its embassy and kill its personnel in Kabul. The Pakistanis say the Indians are helping the Baloch insurgency in Balochistan province and are funding it. So there's this very serious breakdown of relations in Afghanistan. And certainly one of the things we need to do, and particularly the Americans need to do, before they pull out, is to get some kind of agreement between India and Pakistan on reducing their hostility towards one another in Afghanistan. Otherwise, you're going to make Afghanistan a new battleground for India-Pakistan rivalries, which, of course, will be devastating for the Afghans.
To what extent has this Frankenstein seeped into the military, and is it affecting the unity of the military with regard to its strategy and its changing strategy? In other words, do we have to worry in the West about the breaking apart of the Pakistan military?
Well, I think it's a growing concern. It hasn't happened yet, and I don't see it happening immediately. But there are, the same pressures that exist on the country as a whole, on civil society, this overall breakdown, the economy, social structure, lack of infrastructure, lack of investment, hostility from neighboring countries, the breakdown with relations with the U.S. I mean, all this is, just as it's affecting the government and society, it's also affecting the officer class in the military. So, for example, I mean, one thing has been clearly that there's an enormous growth of anti-Americanism inside the military. Now, where will this lead to? Will the military high command be able to tame it and control it? You know, but this anti-Americanism is one of the reasons why the high command actually broke off relations with the U.S. November, December of 2011. I think the military high command is very aware that there are very serious problems now inside the military. Islamic fundamentalism is spreading. Anti-Americanism is spreading. Now, that doesn't mean that there's going to be a breakdown of the military, because the military is a British, trained force. It's an American trained force. It hasn't just, it's been around for 200-300 years as a kind of centralized hierarchical force, whether it was the British Army of India or, subsequently in the 50s and 60s, the American trained army for the Cold War. So it remains very disciplined, very hierarchical, very much aware of its own interests. It has huge economic interests. The officers benefit from housing and cars and enormous luxuries that civil society just doesn't have. They don't pay any bills. They after retirement, they go into economic jobs, factories and all, which are run by the military. The military also knows that if there's a revolt inside, these perks and privileges will be the first thing to go, because already civil society is demanding that the military must stop sucking the country's economy and give something back into the economy rather than just spending.
President Obama came into office saying this was the good war, and as opposed to the Iraq war, which he didn't apply an adjective to. What has been the inadequacy of his policy? I mean, he really had noble ideas about how he would change the situation, but in the end, nothing came of it.
I think the biggest problem with Obama has been his inconsistency. The policy has changed so many times in the last 4 years. Even the U.S. military is confused as to exactly, what the policy is. I mean, if you look at it, I mean, when Bush went, there was a surge. And that surge was very generally supported by many people, including the Afghans, because he really promised a lot of money and aid to the civilian sector. The economy, infrastructure, roads, et cetera, Then that never really took off because, the war intensified and those civilian Americans, more than 1,000 of them, couldn't get into the countryside. Then he promised a regional compact. In other words, the neighboring countries of Afghanistan would be brought together by the Americans to agree to help Afghanistan, not to interfere and stoke up more trouble as they did in the 90s. That never happened. Obama took India off the list because unless you resolve India and Pakistan rivalry in Afghanistan, and unless you face up to that, you don't get a resolution. And so that policy kind of fell by the wayside. Then if you look at the military side, we had all this counterterrorism doctrine, with the manual and the book by General Petraeus. And this counterterrorism that had been so-called successful in Iraq was transported to Afghanistan. 120,000 troops came in. NATO was told to step up its, now we have about 150,000 troops. And then this whole counterterrorism, which was supposed to be pro-people, defending the people and allowing civil activity to take, this fell by the wayside, And There now seems to be almost a kind of guerrilla attacks are continuing, but there seems to be not a counterterrorism strategy particularly, but more of a sort of bunker strategy. The Western troops are kind of holed up in their bases and camps. And are not very active. Instead, what is happening is now that the Americans have decided to build an army, you know, an Afghan army to replace them. They want an army and a police force of 350,000 men. But that was then reduced to 220,000 men. And finally, I think the biggest blunder was the inconsistency of announcing the surge and announcing a withdrawal date, if you remember. In 2009, when Obama says, I'm sending, you know, so many tens of thousands of more troops, but we will withdraw by 2014. And so you are withdrawing as part of a political agenda which is based in America.
Which is to get out,
but which is basically based on your election timetable and congressional election timetable. You are not basing a withdrawal on real improvements on the ground, conditions improving on the ground, you know. And the military were flummoxed. They said, look, we are happy to withdraw when you say you're the president, but, you know, I mean, let us tell you when conditions have improved on the ground sufficiently so we can withdraw and hand over to the Afghan army. Now, that's not being done. So there's tension between the military and the White House.
So what is imposed on this situation is a mixture of inertia, non-attention by the president, and an inability to control the fragmentation in his own government.
Well, I wouldn't call it inertia because, I mean, there's been a lot of focus on Afghanistan. But I would agree that, you know, unfortunately, the president has, you know, given these has given it a lot of time, but has not really given the policy or the issue a personal stamp. You know, the personal authority of the president. He's absent. You know, he doesn't talk about Afghanistan. He rarely goes there. He rarely meets with Afghans. He just seems absent from the whole, you know, he has all these policy briefings in the special room, you know, the basement of the White House. But we don't know what happens there. And it doesn't really show the Afghan people or the region or the public, that the American public, that he's really involved with Afghanistan. So I think that's the first thing. I think the second problem is that he came in with hugely noble intentions on everything, the economy, you know, putting right, healthcare, all these domestic issues, withdrawing from Iraq and Afghanistan. But much of the team that he brings in are old former Republicans or the team from the Clinton era. You know, he doesn't bring in his own younger people with more perhaps radical ideas, better ideas. And certainly in foreign policy and the economy. I mean, if you look at the team that he gathered initially on the economy, they were all the Bush people. He bought in. And he did almost the same thing in foreign policy, where he gave the State Department to Hillary Clinton. Hillary bought in all Bill Clinton's, you know, people from the 90s and a lot of Republicans, giving them top jobs in the State Department. And there was a natural and then the Obama people in the White House basically ignored the State Department because they considered it Hillary's territory and off limits. So for the first 2 years of the Obama administration, where Richard Holbrooke was given the task of coordinating this AFPAC, as it was called, policy, there was real chaos because the White House was not talking to the State Department. And Obama was not even talking to Holbrooke. Holbrooke never had a one-to-one session with President Obama. And that's tragic. You know, there was complete disconnect within the administration. And I mean, that's not just, you know, I'm not just saying that. It's been documented by a lot of people. So I think, you know, his noble ideas, his passion, his desire to get out of these wars, not to get the U.S. involved in more wars, his desire to reduce the defense budget, all these are very noble aims and very necessary if America is to remain a big power. But, you know, it was the inconsistency. And again, you know, the infighting, which he didn't stop. And ultimately, the lack of his stamp on the policy, you know.
Now, how has he changed policy toward Pakistan, and what has been the impact of, I believe you say in the book that he turned the drone technology from a tactic into a strategy?
Well, what happens with Pakistan is initially, first of all, Bush doesn't recognize Pakistan as a problem and this fact that the Taliban have sanctuaries in Pakistan. Obama does, and he sees that Pakistan is critical to any withdrawal in Afghanistan. And Holbrooke, Congress, Obama were united initially in wooing Pakistan, basically. If you remember, there was, the U.S. was giving something like $2 to $3 billion a year to the military. And then there was this Kerry Lugar bill that promised $1.5 billion a year to the civilian sector. And it was the first time since the 50s when the U.S. actually gives real money to the civil sector for development, because previously U.S. money has always gone to the military or to the intelligence services. And so there was a real possibility of improvement. But at the same time, as I described earlier, the Pakistan military doesn't go after the Afghan Taliban. It doesn't go after these people, these terrorists who are living in the tribal areas in Pakistan. And increasingly, the military, the intelligence in Washington starts depending on covert forces, special forces, drone attacks, to take out these people in Pakistan. Now, obviously, that is impinging on the sovereignty of Pakistan, because you're sending in special forces, or you're attacking with drones, killing people on the Pakistan side of the border, in a country which is ostensibly an ally of the U.S. And this creates enormous resentment in Pakistan, in the public, in the media, in the military. And eventually, I mean, last year, it literally did become a strategy of the U.S., because as U.S. options were narrowed down and there was greater hostility from Pakistan towards the U.S., aid becomes postponed, delayed, and then the U.S. just cuts it. And Congress demands that, no more aid to Pakistan. And then, of course, the killing of Osama bin Laden, which was very necessary as far as the U.S. was concerned, but was twisted around by Pakistan to show that the U.S. impinged on our sovereignty, which was a fact. It did. But the question then is, which the military fails to answer in Pakistan, is why did the military not get Osama before? Why did the military allow him to stay, right next door to the military academy in this town of Abbottabad? So, the whole relationship becomes much more fraught and difficult, and leading to the tragedy in November 24th when nearly 24 Pakistani soldiers were killed by American helicopters on the Pakistani side of the border. And it was a mistaken thing, according to the Americans. According to the Pakistanis, it was deliberate. The Americans were trying to provoke Pakistan. And since then, we've had a complete breakdown in relations. And aid has stopped. Money has stopped. Relations have stopped.
And the caravans carrying goods through Pakistan have been denied that route.
Yeah, Pakistan has closed down the major route, which was supplying something like 60% of the needs for the NATO forces in Afghanistan. That road has been closed since November. Obviously relations will get back to some kind of level in the weeks and months ahead, but I think they'll never be what they were. Obviously at some stage we'll reopen the road. We probably charge you something now, which we didn't do before. In fact, we should have done before. I mean, we should have charged the Americans so that we could have built new roads with that money. But relations will never get back to what they were. And I think the level of mistrust now between the two militaries and the two intelligence services, the CIA and the ISI in Pakistan, is enormous. And it's not going to go away at the drop of a hat.
So in a way, the in this relationship of mutual dependence, Everybody had an interest in keeping the game going, but now the game is changing, as we've discussed across the board. And so, what should be the goal of the end state? There's change. The old relationship was inadequate. What should the U.S. and Obama be doing to secure the Pakistani relationship in the new narrative?
Well, I think what is absolutely critical for the Americans, given the withdrawal from Afghanistan, is that they have to secure Pakistan's support and help to bring about a peaceful resolution in Afghanistan to end the civil war. Now, you can't talk to the Taliban because the Taliban are all living in Pakistan. And that is a primary card that Pakistan holds. That the Americans say, well, you know, let us talk to the Taliban. Pakistan will say, yeah, but you do A, B, C, D first, and then we let you talk to the Taliban. Now, what is broken down is that negotiation as to what this new formula will be. Pakistan is encouraged to bring the Taliban forward and perhaps even take part in the negotiations themselves for the future of Afghanistan with the Americans, with Hamid Karzai. But in return, then, you know, what are the Americans going to give Pakistan? I think that is going to be the crucial element of this, because the Americans know they can't leave Afghanistan without having a dialogue with Pakistan as to how this will all work out in the end. The difference, as you say, is that the end game has begun. The end game being the American withdrawal from Afghanistan and the fact that Pakistan now has to, if you like, surrender its assets being the Afghan Taliban. But it has to surrender its assets in a way that it will help Pakistan also, help Pakistan vis-a-vis India, help Pakistan vis-a-vis Afghanistan. Now, the whole doubt and uncertainty in many people's minds is that the Pakistanis are not looking for a sort of facilitating role in Afghanistan to facilitate a peace settlement between Karzai and the Taliban, but are looking for a domineering role in Afghanistan, that the military wants to dominate Afghanistan. And the military has not really made it clear as to what it wants. And this is the dialogue that will have to take place with the Obama camp now and Pakistan to get the relationship back on track. In other words, how will Pakistan help the U.S. in talks with the Taliban, secure its own interests also, and eventually support a peace process in Afghanistan?
Now, in your book, you give us new information about the dialogue between the Americans and the Taliban, the setting up of an office in Doha. Talk a little about that, because the Obama administration has been on and off again with regard to actually talking with the Taliban, and of course we now have the electoral campaign in the United States, where this may become a controversial issue and make matters worse.
This goes back actually to more than 2 years to when Richard Holbrooke was alive and was running the policy. He was first approached by the Germans, who said that there are Taliban who want to talk to you. And he gave the go-ahead to the Germans, who got in touch with the Qataris, because the Taliban wanted an Arab state to support any negotiations. And for about a year, you had Germans, Qataris, and the Taliban, representatives of Mullah Omar, the Taliban leader, meeting in Qatar to pave the way for an eventual dialogue with the Americans. And that happened, at the beginning of 2011. And so you had you had the Qataris, the Germans, the Americans, and the Taliban representatives all meeting together. And the first aim was basically how to build trust with one another. And the aim was that the Taliban made certain demands. They wanted their prisoners released. They wanted certain things done. The Americans have also wanted their prisoners released. The Taliban are holding an American soldier. But unfortunately, President Karzai was very much part of this process. He was consulted regularly. He was told what was happening. He said, that's fine. If they want to talk to the Americans first, that's fine. But you, America, have to make sure that down the road, we are included also, we, the Afghan government. So, but right at the end, when the Taliban were ready, and then it was proposed that the Taliban would open an office in Qatar so that there would be a permanent kind of location where anybody could go and talk to the Taliban, the Americans, the British, anybody else. And right at the last minute, when this was supposed to be announced at the Bonn summit at the end of 2011, Karzai threw a fit and cancelled his agreement, and so the whole process was delayed interminably. Then you had this huge breakdown between Pakistan and the United States in November 2011, which certainly lasted 4 or 5 months. And then you had also, you had an American election season building up, and you suddenly had this spate of criticisms by the Republican candidates, Gingrich, Romney, Santorum, saying, why is Obama talking to the Taliban? This is a letdown. This is a sellout. He's letting down the women of Afghanistan and everything we've achieved. So for all these multiple reasons, suddenly the talks go down. The level of the dialogue goes down and things get put on hold. I think now they're about to be revived. I hope that between what is now March 2011 and the American elections in November, we will not see a complete drawdown on these talks. Because the fear is that the administration may say, oh, we better go easy on these talks because otherwise Republican candidates will denounce us as selling out. And Obama, of course, has always been desperately keen to appear tough on national security policy because that's the big stick that the Republicans use to bash the Democrats always. So anyway, I hope that this policy will continue. I think the next thing we're going to see is the creation of an office in Doha and then an exchange of prisoners. And then what we hope, what it could lead to finally, is some negotiations about confidence-building measures, which are called CBMs on the military front. So, for example, it could be that the Taliban promised to stop killing people in this province or two provinces for a certain time frame. And the Americans say, okay, we won't launch any night raids or any attacks in the same provinces for, say, the next 2 months. And let's test each other. Let's see if the Americans keep their promise. Let's see if the Taliban can keep their promise. And then perhaps we could expand this into a broader kind of non-violent pact. I won't call it a ceasefire because that has a lot of political connotations. And then, of course, the next step would be once you've established some kind of military trust and you've been able to reduce the violence on the ground, you could then start talking real politics, the issue, bring in Karzai, the government, and talk about power sharing between the government and the Taliban.
This is really a complex problem, moving to some sort of stability with America leaving. So we have to leave in a judicious manner. We have to be concerned about stability in Afghanistan. We have to be concerned in the background about Pakistan's stability and relations with India. Now, I'm sure our audience is interested. There have been a number of shall we say, tragedies, disasters with regard to America's presence in Afghanistan, the desecration of Afghan dead, the burning of the Quran, and now this horrific incident with the killing. How will that impact the ideal path that you just described toward peace?
Look, obviously it will impact, and it will create a lot of anti-Americanism within the government, within the Afghan army, within the public at large. But I think one thing is very positive is that nobody, including the Taliban, have talked about breaking off the talks. And that is extremely important. I mean, the Taliban have condemned the Americans. They've said we'll seek revenge, we'll kill American soldiers. But they have not talked about breaking off the talks. And I think that is, you know, incredibly important. Now, on the other hand, certainly to get the talks moving, I think what this administration will need to do is give, you know, you need a multi-dimensional approach to this. You've got to have a very good diplomatic team who are going to hold negotiations with the Taliban. You need an extremely good diplomatic team who are going to hold negotiations with the neighboring states to bring about some kind of regional compact. You've got to deal with your own allies in NATO, some of whom may want to pull out of Afghanistan in the next 3 to 4 months. So you need a much more enhanced diplomatic effort than what we're seeing at the moment by the Obama administration. Now, will Obama do this before the November elections? This is the question. Can he? It's a gamble. It may not work. You know, at the end of the day, the Taliban may say, well, I'm sorry, you are leaving, you know, and we won't play ball. But I think they will. And so you need all these multidimensional things. And the aim ultimately should be, I think, two things. First of all, you need an orderly withdrawal. You do not want to be attacked as you withdraw. You know, that'll be a disaster. Secondly, it'll be a disaster both for you and for the Afghans and for the region as a whole. But more important than that, even, I think, what needs to be done is that you need to have brought the civil war to an end. If not an end, at least you need to have brought the violence down substantially before you leave. Because it's unlikely that anybody else is going to be able to do what the Americans can do in the next 18 months. So that's why these talks are so important. If at the end of 18 months you, because I don't believe that the Afghan army, and you know the Americans have spent $12 billion a year on the Afghan army for the last 3 years. I don't believe the Afghan army will be able to stand up to the Taliban for more than a year. You know, the government will collapse. The army itself may collapse or split or become just a factionalized army. So you can't trust the Afghan army to replace you and continue fighting the Taliban for ad infinitum. You need to bring the war to an end. That has to be the political aim. You've got 18 months to do it. You know, can this administration do it? In the midst of an election campaign. And many of the measures the administration will need to take will appear to be concessions to the Taliban. And they will be pounced on by the Republicans. So there are risks involved, you know. But making peace after a 10-year war, obviously, is going to be a risky business.
Well, on that note, Ahmed, I want to thank you for being here. Let me show your book one more time. And again, thank you for sharing your insights with us.
Thank you very much.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.